Hi, I'm Paul, and I'm an alcoholic. A little bit of what it was like and what happened and what it's like now. I grew up in West Virginia, and I was trouble from the get-go. I rebelled about everything and anything there was to rebel about. I had two older brothers that beat the crap out of me every once in a while. And I was raised by a domineering stepmother that to the day she went to her grave, her and I were like, you know, that old thing where you throw a couple cats tied over a rope, you know. Well, that was our relationship. And but anyway, I grew up in a steel mill town, and I didn't like it growing up in West Virginia in that steel mill town, and I knew as soon as I could possibly do it, I was getting the hell out of there. And I had already had a few bouts with alcohol. You know, I would steal alcohol from the local bars and steal cigarettes and stuff like that. I was always into something. But anyway, when I was 17, I blackmailed my father, and I told him if he didn't sign for me to join the Navy, that he'd never see me again. And he knew that from my personality that that's exactly what would happen. And I'll never forget him sitting out on the back porch crying, saying, "What did I do wrong?" But anyway, I ran off to the Navy, and I became a good old-fashioned Navy drunk. And, you know, I did all the things that the sailors do. I slept in the alleys in Hong Kong and the rooftops in Singapore. And a few of my highlights, one of my biggie things towards hitting my bottom was when I got caught trying to climb a chain link fence with 5 gallons of medical alcohol. I worked as a metalsmith, and somehow they had sent it to the welding shop by mistake. And I just knew if I got my hands on that alcohol, I was going to be in hog heaven. But luckily I got caught, because if I know the way I went about things, I'd be dead, you know. But anyway, I had good times and bad times in the Navy. And I rode aircraft carriers for 14 out of 20 years. Flew helicopter rescue, and at one point, I had about some of the best duty you could get, as I was stationed in Pax River, Maryland, and we'd fly on a Super Connie doing magnetic tracks around the world, and we all wore civilian clothes, and we operated out of all the Air Force bases, and we had the highest rating right underneath the presidential aircraft. But, you know, typical for me, I got drunk and got thrown off the flight crew. And I ended up where I was pulling all kinds of stunts, you know. I mean, I would go out on a bender, and I knew if I went back to the barracks and went to bed that I wouldn't make it into work. So I'd go back to the base, and I'd put on my work uniform, and I'd go down and climb on top of my workbench and go to sleep. So I knew when they had muster in the morning, I'd be in the metal shop. And, you know, stunts like that, I was known as one of the local squadron drunks. And there was a few guys that went for treatment. At that time, they had started up a treatment center up in Long Beach. And they came back, and they ended up going back out drinking. And I got to the point that I was... Right here in San Diego, I was sitting in the Copper Penny Lounge. You know, I like these quiet places where you could just sit and suck stuff down. And I had bought a motorhome, and I would park it behind the Copper Penny Lounge, and I'd go in and give the bartender, Gino, my car keys and tell him not to let me drive. But I had a key to get in it so I could go in there and pass out when I reached that point. But anyway, it ended up the command sent a couple guys in working uniform right to the bar, and they came in and they dragged me out like this and right straight up to the commanding officer's office. And they gave me a choice of either going to Long Beach, or they were going to process me out of the Navy. And at that time, I had 15 years in. And so I went to Long Beach, and I drove my motorhome up. And my brother lived up in that area, and I went to his house before I had to report in for treatment. And I promptly went to Redondo Beach and tied on my last drunk, and somehow I fell up a flight of stairs. I woke up in the morning with, you know, my face stuck to the pillow from where I'd split my forehead open. So I went in with, you know, a big bandage on my head, and they promptly put us on antabuse and gave us vitamins, and they handed us the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a 12 and 12, and a book called Search for Serenity. And there was 10 men to a group, and we had a submarine cook that was our counselor that had 7 years sobriety. And that was bizarre because, you know, it was in an old wooden barracks, and I'd be fine. And time to eat, I'd walk down to the hospital ship, and I'd be just fine. I wouldn't be shaking or anything, and I'd get in there in front of that plate of food, and I was like just trying to get it to my face. But that's some of the things I went through, you know. But at the first AA meeting I went to, there in the barracks, 4 of us from our group got way in the back. And our counselor come down and he told us, he says, you get your ass up front with the winners and you stay there. And that made a big impact on me. So ever since, I try and sit up pretty close to the front row, if not right in it. And, you know, it's held me in good stead. And thanks to the grace of God, you know, I've got 39 years sobriety. You know, I love to tell the newcomers, you know, to hang on to your ass because you're in for one hell of a ride. And, you know, to me today, being able to share and go to meetings and see the newcomers and stuff like that is my way of doing 12-step work. You know, back when I first got sober, I was one of the first collateral duty counselors the Navy had when they started their alcoholism program. And I worked right with commanding officers. When somebody had a drinking problem, I was there. And I'd go through his personnel record, and I'd end up most of the time telling the commanding officer, hey, you can't throw the man out. You need to get treatment so we don't lose all that money we've invested in him. And when you put it to them that way, see, it registered because they've seen the greenback. But anyway, I come back off a cruise early in sobriety, and I called my wife and I said, hey, I says, I'm bringing a guy home. And it was Christmas, and they were going to put him in the brig until they could get him into treatment. And I said, no, that's not fair to the man. You're going to lock him up on a holiday and punish him for being a drunk. And they said, well, what do we do with them? And I said, I guess I have to take him home. So here I come home from a six-month cruise, and my wife meets me, and I got this drunk tagging along, you know. But anyway, you know, that was some of the things that happened. And, you know, we had a lot of people sleeping on our couch early in sobriety, both men and women. And Terry was real active in the program. I have to regress a little bit. When I was in the treatment center, I went to a meeting and I seen a lady sitting there crocheting. And I thought, man, that lady got it together. Well, come to find out, she was as sick as I was because she was in a women's recovery home called the House of Hope up in Long Beach. And we got together and had a baby and got married. And It ended up that lasted about a year, and I was stationed up at Miramar, and she ran off with my best friend in Alcoholics Anonymous, and damn, I miss him. But, you know, she's still sober today. And, you know, it's one of them miracles that when that marriage broke up, I knew I did not want to be alone. I mean, I sobered up when I was 31, so I'd been a bachelor a lot of years. And I knew that having a good relationship was worth its weight in gold. It's just that didn't happen to be the one. But I got on my knees, and I asked God for one time in my life, other than asking to be sober, you know, that he knew what my needs were. Well, a couple of weeks later, I got struck with Cupid's arrow or whatever you call it, in heat or whatever. And I met my present wife, and she was in Alcoholics Anonymous and had over a year sobriety, so I wasn't 13th stepping. But anyway, we got together, and she had six kids. I married her with six kids. And it was the most natural thing in the world, you know, because those kids accepted me, and I felt like, you know, I belonged to be in a big family. But, you know, a day at a time, Terry and I have been together 37 years. But, you know, Terry works her program, and I work mine. And it's a gift of God that has put us together. And even in sobriety, you know, if you work this program and you live the program, you know, I'm not a big book thumper. You know, I did my inventory. I worked the steps. I had a sponsor, went through all the rigmarole for many, many years. But the thing is, every once in a while, I'll go to a book study just to refresh my mind up here because I got CRS. But, you know, this program is so amazing. And, you know, I really feel to my deepest part of me that, you know, this program was a gift of God. And I was talking to a new guy last night at a meeting, and, you know, he was talking about his religion and God and everything. And I'm telling him, hey, you know, it's a two-way street. It's okay to have your church. It's okay to have your religion. But you need Alcoholics Anonymous, because if you're like me, you've got that addictive personality. And, you know, it's just amazing how you can have so many things in your life. If I had sat down as a newcomer and I'd have made up a list of what I wanted in life, and I'd have wrote it out, and I tell people, I say, take and do that. Write it out and put it away and go work your steps and stay in the program. And at whatever point you want, you know, wait 5 years, 10 years, whatever, and you dig that list out, you'll find out that you cheated yourself so much. Because to this very day, I don't know what God has in store for me. Absolutely no idea. The only thing is, I know I like the journey. You know, part of my thing when I was trying to sort out who I was and where I came from and everything is I went on a spiritual quest, and I had Bible study groups in my house, and I did all the things that most of us are going to do or have done. But I finally started reading some of Emmett Fox, and I read Cahil Gibran, where he talked about the journey. And I was raised in a church where I tried to live by the Ten Commandments. Forget it. For me, it was a wasted effort. I mean, my personality definitely did not go along with the Ten Commandments. I'll tell you that. And, you know, after a point, you know, it's like, hey, I've committed every sin you can possibly commit, so I might as well enjoy myself. But that's kind of the way it went, you know. But anyway, I found the God of my understanding. And, you know, my God walks his journey with me on a daily basis. And I don't have any big deals today, you know. I don't have to go crazy trying to save the world, you know. I just live today to the best of my ability, as I feel my God of my understanding wants me to treat people and to be treated. And, you know, it's I don't know. It's amazing for me, you know, that I can lay down at night and I can go to sleep and I don't have any regrets. About 3 years ago, we were living down in Arizona, and I was doing some pick and shovel work, helping her plant some cactus and stuff. And I went to bed, and I knew something wasn't right, and I told Terry to call the paramedics. Well, they rushed me into the hospital, and I was totally paralyzed on my left side. And basically a paraplegic. Couldn't move nothing. Had no feeling, nothing. And they flew me in to Eisenhower Hospital, and the leading neurosurgeon came into the room, and he started showing me these tests and saying what all he had to do. And I stopped him dead in his tracks, and I said, hey, you know, I said a prayer to my God, and I said, now I'm going to say a prayer asking him to guide your hand, and you do whatever you have to do. And he was flabbergasted. I mean, his mouth kind of flopped open, and he just looked at me and says, okay. Well, at that time, I didn't know he was a leading neurosurgeon for 4 or 5 years in a row, and that he had a gift that God had given him. So, you know, I went through surgery, and then they sent me to a rehab hospital, and I had to learn to walk all over again and everything. And, you know, it's those miracles that happen in life that I'd have died a drunk laying in the gutter somewhere. Because, you know, back when, I knew exactly. One time I was up at my brother's house, and he caught a lot of the brunt of my drinking because he was local. But I used to go to his house all the time, and they'd throw me out and take my key away from me. And, you know, pretty soon I'd go back, and they'd give me my key back, you know. But anyway, on one of my drunken things, you know, he told me, he says, I told him I wanted to get out of the Navy and just be a drunk, be a bum. And he says, you can't be a bum. He says, we got family pride. And I said, okay, I'll get out of the Navy and be a proud bum. I mean, that's the way my head worked, you know. But, you know, when I got sober, my family was there for me. And, you know, I never, I don't know, my thing with my parents, I ended up in the psychiatric hospital in Philadelphia. And I went there, they flew me up there from Key West, Florida. And I told the psychiatrist, I said, hell, in Key West, I said, there's nothing to do but fish or swim, and I don't do either one of them, so I drink. And anyway, I think the only reason I didn't get thrown out of the Navy then was because he was like me, you know. I think he kept a bottle in his desk or something, because every once in a while I got a whiff of booze. But anyway, I took off and went back to West Virginia to tell him what was going on and why I was in this psychiatric hospital. And meanwhile, they had flown to Philadelphia to find out what's going on with me, and then nobody there would tell him anything. Because of confidentiality thing, you know, Navy hospital. But anyway, you know, that's the kind of stuff that went on. And when I got sober, one of my main goals was to stay sober to make those amends to my parents and the people I had hurt. And, you know, I could go home and I could tell them I was sorry and that I was self-will run riot and all the stuff, but it didn't mean anything. At least not to me. To them, you know, they said, oh, it's all right, you're our son. But I had to walk one day at a time in sobriety as part of that amends to the people I had hurt, which was primarily my family. Because I always said, hey, you know, I'm free, white, and 21, and I'm out doing my thing, and, you know, I'm not hurting anybody. I'm not accountable to anybody. In the Navy, you know, you get your monthly allowance of money and food and whatever, and you got a roof over your head, so, you know, I enjoyed it. But anyway, you know, it was part of my amends to stay sober and that they never had to see me drunk again. And it ended up that at one point in my sobriety, I lost my dad in August, and I lost my mother in October. And, you know, I was able to go back with my brother and help sort out the family home and all that. But, you know, some of the bad times we've had in the Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't want to be morbid, but we're all going to walk through them if we live long enough. And, you know, it ended up that we had one of our sons that was away at college, and he went out and hung himself with the jumper cables from his car. And we get this call. You know, we're up in Idlewild. We're living in the Idlewild Mountains up there. Had a cabin up there. And you talk about Alcoholics Anonymous being there for you. I mean, I swear the people must have called each other and said, well, I'll be over there from such and such a time, and you be there for such and such a time. But they were there for us. And it really mattered. And the funeral was down here in San Diego. And I remember driving to that funeral. I had a little sports car at the time. And I ran into the back of a guy on the freeway. He stopped and I didn't. And it wasn't a real big thing, you know. It didn't even hardly dent either one of our cars. And he come back and I was a mess. Just a complete mess. And I told him I was on the way to my son's funeral. And he says, hey, he says, don't worry about this accident. He says, there's not that much damage to my car. And he said, you go and try and have as good a day as you can, you know, and wish me luck. But, you know, those are the things that they happen. You know, you live with them. And when you lose a child, you know, the pain never totally goes away. But, you know, you learn to live with it. And later we lost a grandson drowned in a swimming pool accident up in Portland, Oregon. And, you know, I mentioned all these different places. Terry and I, you know, people shake their head at how we do things, you know, because we've lived in the Oceanside Harbor on a 42-foot cruiser sedan. We've had multiple cabins up in the Idlewild Mountains. We were full-time RVers for 9 years. We lived down in the desert. We still got a home down in Quartzsite, Arizona. And, you know, all these things that I guess our insanities run the same way. Because, you know, it's like, hey, this seems like a good idea. Let's go do it, you know. And sometimes it's her idea and I'm crazy enough to go along with it or vice versa, but it works, you know. And our kids, you know, they just kind of shake their head. But the thing is, we've had a real good relationship with our kids. And here a while back, about 6 months ago, our daughter wanted an investment. And she says, well, if I buy a house, would you come up and live in it? She says, you're too old to be down there in the desert by yourself. Well, we were having fun. You know, I think it should be a prerequisite that, you know, when your kids grow up and leave the nest, that you get yourself an RV and take off and see the country and go to meetings all over and all that stuff, you know. We were flying through Texas one time, and here we seen, as I rounded a turn on this highway, great big A8 sign on the side of this building. I mean, huge letters. We said, well, hell, that's where we belong. So we wheeled in there. And it was kind of bizarre because there they had an old folks and a young folks club. And we happened to hit the old folk. Well, nobody even hardly bothered to say hi or goodbye or anything. And this one guy finally comes up and he says, hey, he says, you guys are still kind of young. He says, if you go 2 blocks down the street, the young people broke off and started their own club. So we went down there, and they had a great big potluck going on. They invited us to stay that night and, you know, wanted us to just park our RV out there, and they'd run electricity to us and all this. But, you know, we were footloose and fancy-free. But one of our little side trips is we were in Ohio, and we pulled into this RV park, and there was a guy in there, and Terry and I were trying to figure out a good place to eat, so I said, well, let's ask one of the locals. So we went over and asked this guy, and he says, oh, yeah, go here, here, and here. So anyway, we unhook our rig, and we get in the car and take off to go get some supper, and we come back, and this guy's sitting in our sight. I told Terry, what the hell's he doing there? Well, he was programmed. And he said, have you been to Akron, Ohio for Founders Day? We said, no. He said, well, he said, that's this coming weekend. He said, I'm going. Do you want to follow? Well, this is 200 miles back. You know, so we said, hey, sounds like a good idea to me. One more time. But anyway, we got to go to Founders Day, you know, and got the traditional hug up on the porch where they said they've been waiting on us. And it was an amazing experience. It really was. And just all those miracles that happen, you know. And for me, if I'm just willing to see the miracles, you know. When I first got sober, I was probably the most negative person that ever walked. In fact, that's one of the things I can thank my ex-wife for, is because we got into this thing of trying to change the way we lived and change our attitudes and everything. And we'd leave a meeting and I'd say, yeah, old Charlie, you know, he ain't got a prayer staying sober and doing all this judgmental crap. And she'd look at me and say, do you really mean that? And I'd say, well, let me see if I can rephrase that in a more positive manner. But, you know, it's amazing. I came home one day, and here Terry, there's a note. She went on a 12-step call with my ex-wife. You know, women working with women, you know. So the two of them got together and went on a 12-step call. But, you know, it's these kind of things that, you know, if you live life on life's terms, and, you know, there's so many things that we have done together in sobriety, and I don't want to rub it in about having the kind of relationship I have with a sober alcoholic woman. But, you know, for us, that's what it took, and that's the way it is. And, you know, we got a couple here that met in the program. And Terry was sponsoring a gal up in Carlsbad one time. And Terry 12-stepped her, and I come home from work, and they're in the house talking. And I told Terry, I said, damn, I said, that woman don't look like an alcoholic. She's too good-looking. And I walked outside and looked at her car and went back in and told Terry, I said, oh, hell yeah, she's an alcoholic. That car had more bourbon bumps than you'd ever see. But, you know, we used to go to the Saturday night San Marcos group, and back then they kind of called it the Kissy Huggy group. Because when you came up to the front door, there was a great big line of men and a big line of women, and you get to shake the men's hand and you get a smooch from the ladies. Well, you know, we were taking Michael there to that meeting, this gal that Terry was working with, and we all sat in the front row. And it even got to the point after enough years of that being our home group that if we didn't go to the meeting, nobody sat in them seats. Because those were Terry and Paul's seats. But anyway, this other guy started coming up there where Michael used to sit beside Terry. And he was married. But we had this camping group, and we were going out camping and everything. And one weekend, you know, I look and I see Terry over there with this guy, and boy, she's got that finger going in his face. I thought, uh-oh, somebody's in trouble. Because, you know, she's redheaded and Irish. But anyway, it ended up that the two of them got together. And, you know, they're just like us. They've trudged many, many blessed years of sobriety. And, you know, raised a couple young girls. And did it the way a couple alcoholics will do it, you know. But I don't know, you know. I asked to speak here because it's been a long time since I was able to share as a speaker at a meeting. And that's one of the things that Terry and I are really grateful for, to be back in the San Diego areas. Is we used to like to go to a lot of different type meetings, and we primarily like to go to speaker meetings. And up in San Marcos, they had the same kind of format where they had a 10-minute speaker and then a main speaker, but they added on a short question and answer period where you could ask any question you wanted about their sobriety. But anyway, we missed the speaker meetings, and let me tell you, I hear a lot of people say there is no such thing as a bad AA meeting. I found them. Yeah. Terry and I moved up to Portland, Oregon, and now there's a lot of good meetings, and I don't want to judge them all. But we found a few that we'd go to the meeting, go to the meeting, go to the meeting. Nobody'd stick their hand up. So we were kind of in a quest to find the kind of meetings we liked. And we found a meeting, and it ended up we fit right in just like mom and pop, the whole group. It was a meeting all biker ex-cons. I mean, some of these guys, you know, like I had a guy come up to me one night and says, "Well, Paul," he says, "how do I make amends?" He says, I beat a guy to death to see what it felt like when I was high on cocaine. You know, that kind of gave me an eye-opener. I'm standing there looking up at this guy. But anyway, you know, we fit in. And we find where we're happy in our sobriety. And so to be back in this area and to have the speaker meetings, and, you know, we go to a few of them. But I'm glad to be able to share. And, you know, I love the newcomers. I love the newcomers. This young man last night, he was so emphatic about that Bible and, you know, about AA. And, you know, it made me flash back, because I remember going to participation meetings, and we'd all be sitting around a big table. And back then, we could smoke. So, you know, the whole room would be like a blue cloud. And they'd have a topic where, you know, somebody would say something that was a little off key from what my realization was. And I'd be sitting there just chomping at the bits, you know, waiting to be able to tell them what I thought of the, you know, subject. But, you know, I haven't had that kind of excitement like a newcomer has. You know, it gets to be old school. But the thing is, I don't want to ever forget where I came from. And, you know, I retired from the Navy in 1976. And they told me then, they said, "Well, the retired Navy usually lasts about 10 years. Well, I fooled them all. I'm getting my money's worth from that pension. I got the kind of personality, hell, when I go to a buffet, I want to eat until I'm almost sick because I got to get my money's worth. But anyway, I'm just real grateful to be here. And I don't know how much longer you want me to ramble on, but I want to thank all of you, and I want to congratulate the birthday people, and keep coming back.